For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. It's another Monday night here at Beth Jacob. We only have three more classes following tonight. Three more classes following tonight as we are approaching Shavuos and the conclusion of our fourth year. Really amazing accomplishment to all of you who have been coming out religiously every Monday night to learn a little bit together. Tonight's class is the mystery of reincarnation. It has been dedicated by the friends of Michelle and George Shear in memory of their beloved grandson, Samuel Finn Dana, Shmuel Ephraim, the beloved son of Liesl and Scott Dana. We appreciate all of the friends who got together to dedicate tonight's class in his memory. May his memory be a blessing, particularly during this very difficult time, obviously, for the entire extended family. We appreciate your being here. We appreciate all the friends who got together to acknowledge his memory in a very meaningful way for all of us here tonight. Okay, reincarnation. Reincarnation. I don't know about you, but I feel like I've taught this class before. Sorry, I couldn't help it. I'm sorry. Question is, how many of you feel like you've learned this class before? That's really the question. Deja vu. Reincarnation, the transmigration of souls, as it's referred to in English and Hebrew, it's known as Gilgul or Gilgulim. Gilgul is Galgal, means literally to roll, as if one soul has rolled from one body into another body. Very, very complex, mysterious concepts. The reason why it is so complex and mysterious, there's a simple one and a less simple one. The simple one is because we really have no idea what it's like. That's the simple reason. Why is it so mysterious? Because anything you don't understand, anything you can't wrap your mind around, anything you don't get is going to be, on some level, a bit mysterious. And this is certainly one of those things that we cannot wrap our minds around. What is it like? How does it work? So many questions that I have been asked personally, that I'm sure that you have had on your own. How does it work with second marriages? How does it work with children? Well, if a person's buried over here, then the second existence is buried somewhere else, and can men become women? Can people become animals? Really, really complex, and you are going to get very few answers to those kinds of questions from me tonight, because I have no idea. I don't know. That's not the aspect that we are going to talk about. But there's another reason why it's very complex and mysterious, besides the fact that we can't really wrap our minds around it, and that is because it is a relatively newcomer to the Jewish scene as far as our understanding goes. So what I mean by that is as follows. If you look in our Chumash, our five books of Moshe, which is our source of everything Jewish, you will find absolutely how many words referencing the concept of Gilgul, the transmigration, or reincarnation? Zero, that's correct. So you say, no problem, I'll scan through the Mishnah. How many words will you find in the Mishnah that directly address or give us sources to this concept? Zero, that's correct. And you say, okay, fine, I'll go to the Talmud, 2,711 pages of the Talmud, 7.5 years of story, the repository of everything Jewish, right? How many sources will we find in the Talmud relating to Gilgul? Think it's zero. Yeah, you have two? So explicitly? Explicit sources. We really don't find explicit sources. Where it comes from is from Kabbalah. It comes from the Zohar and the students of the Zohar and of Kabbalah. Now what we're going to see is that they're not going to claim that they made it up. They're going to find all of those references in the Chumash. They're going to find references in Gemaras. They're going to find references throughout old sources, but that it was kept a secret. If you remember when we studied Kabbalah, Kabbalah first really came onto the scene in the 1100s, 1200s, with the printing of the Zohar. The Zohar, which was written much earlier, but was not public knowledge, was not part of the Jewish world. And then it became, if you remember, this was on our class in Jewish history, we discussed this in Great Controversies, we discussed this. Really, the Ramban, who lived in the 1200s, was of the first to really bring it out into the public eye. And from that point on, the Balei Kabbalah, the students of Kabbalah, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, the Arizal, really then made it popular, and then it's continued since then. But it is not rooted in overt, clear-cut sources like almost everything else that we have in Judaism is. Like, why do we do this, that, or the other in Judaism? Well, you go back to a pasuk in Chumash. If you can't go back to a pasuk in Chumash, maybe a Mishnah or the Gemara. But this is really going past that as to where this concept really comes from. To further it, further the confusion, the concept of this transmigration of souls is really a fundamental tenet in other religions. In Hinduism and other Far Eastern religions, it's really a prominent role. And so the question is it really a Jewish thing? Is it not a Jewish thing? We're going to find many, many, many prominent, significant Jewish sources who believe wholeheartedly in this concept. But it was not part of the dialogue in the early parts from the giving of the Chumash all the way until the Middle Ages does it become part of our common language, this idea. The Balei Kabbalah explain, and we'll learn, that it was always there, just wasn't, it was hidden, it was mysterious. That's what Kabbalah is looking beneath the surface, and it had always been there beneath the surface and has been brought to the forefront. So we have all of these aspects. There were significant Jewish thinkers who do not accept this concept. Maimonides primarily amongst them. Maimonides, as we've studied, is a rationalist par excellence, did not believe in this concept. Reb Sadia Gaon, one of the early Gaonim, did not believe in this concept. Yosef Albo, they're significant Jewish thinkers who did not accept this concept. And that is because, since it's not rooted in overt Chumash, Mishnah, Gemara, but in Kabbalah, so with all of that went into the acceptance of Kabbalah, those who did not take that as standard Jewish practice. But I can tell you today it is a part of the Jewish world. The list of those who accept it today ranges across the spectrum from the Vilna Gaon, we'll see, to the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote the Mishnah Brura. It wrote about it as if it was, everybody knows that the souls transmigrate, and that we are all now living a second, third, if not fourth life. At this point, the Balei Kabbalah have expressed that there are no new souls in the world. That all of us today are already trying to work out the problems that we had previously, which is what we'll study about tonight, which is why we're here. So if you always were wondering why you have that one little issue that you can't seem to get around, there's a reason for that. If you ever felt like, it's not fair, I didn't get a clean slate, there's a reason for that too. We are, according to the Balei Kabbalah, all already here multiple times in this travels through the earth that we are currently living. And that is just the backdrop of this discussion. So it's an interesting, it's a mysterious, definitely mystic concept, and we will address it as best we can to try to understand it. Okay, any questions so far? I just as an introduction. All right, so let's go through this and see what it is that we come across. So in letter B, my notes that I have in the front, just to sort of guide our discussion. What is fundamental for this concept is something that we have discussed many, many times. I'll do it briefly, but it needs to be put on the table because this is the key component. So even though I'm not about to say anything new, but we're going to be referencing this, and that is the body-soul relationship when it comes to Jewish thought. And if I were to ask you, what are you primarily? Are you primarily a body that happens to have a soul which gives it life? Or are you a soul with a body that gives it form?
Yes,
excellent, right? That is a very difficult question. The answer to that is yes. But in as much as the answer is yes, we really believe which one is more true? We're a soul. Now, you might all answer that quickly, but that's really a very significant concept for a human being to accept. Because what we feel and touch and see when I'm looking out at all of your beautiful faces, what I'm seeing are beautiful faces. You have an even more beautiful soul behind that, but I can't see that. I don't relate to that as well because I see your beautiful faces. I interact with your bodies. We can shake hands, we can see each other, we talk, we go out for lunch together. But we really believe, it's not just I'm a body that has a soul, I am a soul that is being housed in a body. That is what I am. And that's a very important distinction for every Jew to always be aware of that, because the soul is eternal. with this discussion, without this discussion, even if there is no such thing as reincarnation, the soul itself will be eternal. The soul itself is eternal. It is now encased in a body which gives it the ability to move and accomplish, learn Torah, fulfill mitzvahs, do acts of kindness. But there'll be a time where the soul will shed the body and then simply interact in its normal, true state. I heard an analogy today, even if you think about a person, a spaceman? Astronaut. But there's a better word I'm looking for. But whatever it is, you have a human being in this world. So in this world, I have all the tools that I need to interact. I don't need any special oxygen mask or any special garb. I just am. But if I were to travel into space, so in order for me to interact on Mars, so I don't have the tools to interact in that environment as I am. So what do I need to do in order, if I want to interact on Mars for a little bit of time? So in order for me to interact in Mars, I got to get myself dressed up with the necessary components for that environment. And I have all my gear, and it's a little bit bulky, but that's what I do. And then when I return home, so then I can shed that which I needed for that environment, because that all that bulkiness, and it's so tricky, everything's got to be perfect. If there's a little mistake somewhere in my outfit, I can't survive in that environment. But then when I come back home, I could get rid of that. I don't need that. I am. So if you bump that up a level, that's our same relationship between the soul and the body. The soul is, and in its natural state of eternity, just is. And it interacts in the world of spirituality as it is. But we're sent down to this world, and if you want to know why are we sent down to this world, so we have numerous classes on that. I was like, what's the purpose of all of this? But God desired that we achieve perfection in that state, and so He gave us the tool, the actual body armor that we need to survive and interact in this world. And while we're in this world, we need that, and that body armor is very delicate. Smallest little nothing can throw it off in a way in which you almost can't survive. But then there comes a time where we get rid of that armor and we go back to our natural state, which is the eternal state of the soul. That concept, which we're not going to get into anymore, we've discussed this and you're familiar with that, but that idea that we are a soul and that the body that we have is simply like the clothing, and when one finishes after 120 years in this world, simply removes the garments that it's adorned with now and returns into its more natural, pure state of soul. That we have many sources for, this idea of the body-soul relationship. Plenty of sources that point directly to that. I don't want to spend the time going through them, but if you look at page 3, you'll see various sources 1, 2, and 3. If you want to look at them on your own, you're welcome to. We'll give you various sources in which we see the idea rooted deep into our literature of the concept of the body-soul, body-soul connection. Okay, so where do the Kabbalists point to say, well, that the soul, okay, it's one thing to say that the soul will be eternal, but it's another thing to say that it's going to come back again in another source. And I want to take a moment now and just clarify one other thing. This concept that we're talking about is very different than what we call Tchiyas HaMeisim, the resuscitation of the dead. That is a different concept. That is a concept that a person, after they die, and that the soul will come back and will live again. And that concept, in its simplicity, is in the body, that much more in the way that it lived its life. That concept that the dead will come back to life, will live again, is one of the tenets of our faith. The Rambam lists that as one of the 13 principal tenets of faith, that a person will come back and live again. Now, if you're going to ask me, how does that jive with what we are discussing tonight? My soul has been back here 4 times already. What does it look like when I come back in the normal method? Just like the person who has died comes back. That's a great question. That's a really great question. I don't know the answer to that question. I have no idea.
One soul, 4 bodies?
I have no idea how that works. I really don't. But the concept, what I want to clarify and make sure that it is exceptionally clear to everyone, if you walk out of here and say, I don't believe in the concept of reincarnation. I don't believe in the transmigration of the souls. I will say, you are well-sourced in traditional Jewish thought. It's clearly the minority, but you're well-sourced. You can deny the concept of the transmigration of the souls and don't believe that a soul comes back in a different body or as an animal or a plant. And I will say to you, you're in the minority, but you're well-sourced, and I could point you to a number of sources. What every Jew must believe is that at some point, the soul will live again. The soul-body connection, somehow we make that blessing three times every day. Mechayei hameisim, God will bring those who have died back to life. What that will look like, I also don't know. But that's a concept that after a person dies, they will live again, is not up for discussion. That is a principal tenet of our faith. That before that concept happens, that the soul might come back three more times before the period that we'll call Tchiyas HaMeisim, that the soul has been brought back to life, that's what we're discussing tonight. Yeah?
Is there an ascension? In other words, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was perfect, for argument's sake, and can be more perfect.
Yeah.
Is he going to come back too? Or is
correct. So let me use that as an example. If a human being had achieved absolute perfection in their life, and then after 120 years they died, so that they would not be subject to our discussion of reincarnation, because they did everything, they would still come back during Tchiyas HaMeisim, because every...
No. What would they come back to? Would they be reincarnated?
Yes, I'm saying, let's say they don't need reincarnation, they've accomplished everything, they would still come back to life during the period of Tchiyas HaMeisim. It's going to be a period in world history that there'll be the rebirth of those who have died. What we're discussing tonight is, in between the 1200s where somebody died, and the period of Tchiyas HaMeisim, which we haven't gotten to yet, will that soul have to come back six more times to achieve its perfection so that it can finally die and rest in peace until Tchiyas HaMeisim? That's what we're discussing now. But that there will be a time where the soul will come back to life, that will happen, that's fundamental tenet of our faith. Have I confused everybody yet, or is that clear? So that is to be clear. So in other words, we're discussing the steps in between what happens to the soul until we get to the period of Tchiyas HaMeisim. Everybody has to believe in Tchiyas HaMeisim. That's fundamental. Whether or not it's going to take us six steps until the soul can finally rest in heaven until that point, that's our discussion tonight. We'll see their minority opinion does not believe in that, but the majority of what we'll see is a very common thing. That's our discussion. I'm just trying to frame that and hoping not to confuse it before we even get started. Yes? I'm just getting started. I'm not going to have an answer. I'm not going to have an answer for that question either. If I knew that answer, then I'd be a rich man. I would just set up shop and I would just tell everybody what they need to do. We will talk about it. Sometimes we intuit. There's a certain issue that we struggle with more than everything else, and that those around us don't seem to view it in the same way. Like in our minds, like this is the biggest thing in life. And nobody else seems to have that problem. So there are certain times we get this feeling that this is our task or mission in life. But it's a feeling. There's no prophecy today. Anyone's going to tell you that that's what it is. But it's the concept of having to come back would fit that there is a reason why you needed to come back. Sometimes the reason can be a specific little thing. Or maybe it's a big thing. And sometimes it could be, you know, you just, the previous soul totally messed up its entire life and needed to start again. Maybe it's a big thing. I don't know that. But let's learn a little bit of sources, and then we'll get into some of the concepts and reasons behind it. So a few of the sources, I don't want to spend too much time, but just to give you a sense that when the Kabbalists developed this idea, they were not pulling it out of a hat. They weren't making it up because they read it in some Far Eastern religion. They are finding it in the sources, and just saying, if you look under the layers, you'll find where it is brought out of. So one of them is here on the bottom of page 3. You'll find this is the bracha that Moshe gives to the tribe of Reuven. Now Moshe lived after the death of the actual tribes. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, they died. several 100 years later, Moshe comes onto the scene. I don't know if it's exactly 100, whatever it is. Moshe comes onto the scene, and then the end of Moshe's life, at the end of the 40 years in the desert, he gives blessings, so to speak, to each one of the tribes. And he's speaking to the tribes as a whole. The actual fathers of the tribes have long ago died. And Moshe says to the tribe of Reuven, Yichir Uvein Va'al Yamus, let Reuven live and not die. And it said in a future tense, let Reuven live in the future and not die. In the Targum Unculus, the translation, the Aramaic translation printed, which was an old, old source, right? What does it mean that he should live and not die? He should live the Chaye Alma, in eternal life. Umosa tanino lo yomos, and a second death not die. What would it mean to die a second death? So the Baalei Kabbalah point already to the Targum Unculus, the translation of the Unculus, which was in the period of the Gemara, said a second death, that he should have to only live once and not have to be sent down a second time and then die a second death. The concept of Yibum, the concept of Yibum, that if a man dies, Rachmana Litzlan, a husband dies without any children, his wife doesn't have any children, so his wife then has to marry his living brother. When the Torah describes this concept of what's known as Yibum, of the survive, the widow marrying the brother, this still applies today, if such a situation takes place. But today, the Torah gives two options. One is to actually marry the brother, or to do a process known as chalitza, which she takes off his shoe, and there's a whole procedure that's done in front of a basin. The Torah describes it as follows. It's on the top of page 4. When brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no child, the widow shall not remarry to one not of his kin. She can't just marry whoever she wants, but her brother-in-law shall come to her and take her to himself as a wife and perform the levirate marriage. And it shall be that the firstborn son that she bears shall succeed in the name of his dead brother, that his name not be blotted out from Israel. That the child that's born, the Torah uses a language, Yakum al Shem Achiv, shall take the place of the brother that's died. So the younger brother marries, has a child, and then that child will, so to speak, be that older brother. Very difficult concept. It appears in many places throughout Torah. The Zohar writes that that is the Raza de Gilgul. That is the secret of reincarnation, is in this concept that the Torah says, if a husband were to die without any children, that his brother should marry his wife, and that the children that they have will, so to speak, rebirth the dead brother. That's the secret of reincarnation. The Ramban writes the same thing, that this matter in source number 4 is speaking about the concept of Yibum. This is one of the great secrets of the Torah, genealogy of mankind. It's only known to the eyes of seer. Meaning, this is a secret. When you ask about Yibum, like, how does that work? So, but that's into the concept of Yibum. I asked, when I was my first week in yeshiva, post-high school, I was learning in Eretz Yisrael, and we were studying the Tractate Ksuvos, which deals with marriage, and it made a reference to this concept of Yibum. A reference. And my chavrus and I were these little hot shots fresh out of high school in yeshiva, with the youngest guys in the yeshiva, obviously, but we were like, we're going to learn really well, we're going to get everything. So one of us asked, I don't remember who said, hey, how does that work? Like, what does that mean, that the child will somehow be the deceased brother, live and carry on his name? Like, how does that work? And we had this deep philosophical, existential question as to how it works. And so there was one of the rebbeim in the yeshiva, it was a tremendous talmid chacham, used to sit in the back and just answer people's questions. You'd wait online for like 45 minutes to get to speak with him. And so we thought this was a really important question that we had stumbled across. Like, how does that work? It's a great question. So we waited 45 minutes online, and we finally get our turn, and we say, how does Yibum work? Like, how does it happen that the widow marries the brother, and then all of a sudden, like, the child takes off his glasses, looks at us, and he says, have you learned the entire tractate of Yevamos yet, which deals with this? And I'm like, no. He said, have you learned the Mishnah even, which discusses this? No. Have you learned the verses in the Chumash? No. So he said, why don't you study a little bit more, and then you can come back to me and talk about it. So I still haven't gotten there yet. It's been about 20 years. I don't know what the problem is. But I could tell you that even when I would, he would still say to me, have you studied all the Zohar? This is the secret of reincarnation, says the Ramban, this concept of that Yibum marriage. But just moving on, another places where you find this source, there is a very difficult phrase that we say when we talk about Hashem's 13 attributes of justice. Hashem, Hashem, Kelrachum, Vechanun, Erech, Apayim. So we say, Poked Avon, Avos Al Bonim. The Torah describes that Hashem keeps in mind the transgression of the fathers for their descendants to the third and fourth generation. So that one person can sin, and God will keep an accounting of that, not only to him, but to the next generation, and to the generation after that, and the generation after that. Very like, why should grandchildren, great-grandchildren, be punished for something that their grandfather did? That doesn't seem very fair. But the Torah says it. The Torah says, I'm going to keep an accounting of this one to the second, third, and fourth generation. So Rashi already comments and says, that's obviously not fair. What that means is, if the second and third and fourth generations maintain the same evil behavior as the great-great-grandfather, then they'll get it like a conglomerate punishment. But only if they maintain it, because Rashi is dealing with it on a very rational level. Yeah, you can't get punished for something that was done previously. That's not fair. So yeah, if you keep it up, then you'll get it for everybody. The Zohar writes, and in this type of class you can see where this is going, what does it mean that God will keep an accounting for the second generation, the third, and the fourth? Meaning you will have, you yourself, that same soul, a second, and a third, and a fourth, and I will keep it going until you get it right. Someone mentioned me, there's a certain film that I have to see. I forgot what it's called.
Defending Your Life.
But there's a more popular film called Groundhog Day, which some of you may have seen. Like, you're gonna do it again and again and again until you get it right. So the Zohar writes on that God will keep an accounting from one generation in Source 5. There is but one tree which is planted in a body once, twice, three times, four times, and is punished for the transgressions of the first incarnation. What it means that God will keep an accounting for subsequent generations, meaning that soul will keep coming back in subsequent generations to accept the punishment. The Father, the Son, the third, the fourth generations are all one soul, which has not yet been rectified and has not even tried to rectify itself, and it'll keep coming back. The soul will have to come back over and over again until it gets it right. It's Pasuk in Eov, which also describes this. God does these things with man two or three times, and then to the top of page 5, to bring back his soul from the grave, to bask in the light of the living. The commentators there say, on the simple level, describing a person suffering within his lifetime, that it's as if he keeps coming back. But again, the Baalei Kabbalah, those studiers and students of Kabbalah, understand from that Pasuk in Eov, as a reference to coming back from the grave, literally two, three times over and over again. Now, just one more comment on some of these sources. The Vilna Gaon writes in the box on source number 7, we read on Yom Kippur the story of Yonah, a small little book of the prophets, the book of Jonah, who runs from God's mission to tell the people of Nineveh that they need to repent. And Yonah decides that he doesn't want to carry forth that mission, so instead he gets on a boat, and the boat has rough waters, the people throw him over, he gets eaten by a big fish, and then he gets spit back onto the dry land, and that's the story as it continues, as I'm sure you are familiar. The Vilna Gaon. Now again, I want to remind you, the Vilna Gaon, this is why I want to just stress this for a moment, because what type of group would you say is big into the idea of the transmigration of souls, reincarnation? Chassidim or the Misnagdim, those who were against the Chassidim? And the Chassidim were big into the Zohar, Kabbalistic thought. It was the root of what the Chassidim were into. The Misnagdim were very much opposed to what the Chassidim were introducing. If you want to reference some of our previous classes on great controversies, one would not have thought naturally that the Misnagdim would have gone for this idea unless they really believed that it was true. The Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, who was the unquestioned leader of the Misnagdim. The Vilna Gaon, who felt that everything the Chassidim were doing was a destruction of the Jewish people. The Vilna Gaon believed in Gilgal, in the concept of reincarnation, of the transmigration of the souls. And he learned the entire book of Yonah is a parable for the concept of Gilgal, for the concept of reincarnation. It's in the box here on source number 7 on page 5. That Yonah, who represents the soul, was charged with a mission to fulfill in this world, which is perfecting itself. And the Shema boards a vessel. What's the vessel that Yonah boards? His boat, to journey through this world. And that is our body. And the person tries to flee from God. The body doesn't want its mission. It doesn't want to have to be good. It doesn't want to have to get up for Shachas. It doesn't want to have to put on tefillin and keep Shabbos and Kashrus. It doesn't want any of that thing. And so eventually he flees and he's swallowed up and departs from the world, leaving his task unfinished. And then in the world to come, God says, go back to Nineveh, and the big fish spits Yonah back onto the earth and says, ready to try again? And Yonah has to fulfill his mission again. And the Vilna Gaon sees in this little story a parable for the soul fleeing its mission, trying to get on a boat and run, eventually being swallowed and brought back to the world to try it again. The Chafetz Chaim, who was no chassid either, the Chafetz Chaim, Yisrael Meir Koyen, lived in Raden in the early 19... He was 93 years old when he died, but passed away in the early 1930s. He wrote the Mishnah Brura. Shemir Salashon is our source for Lashon Hara. All sorts of different halachas also write. But that's why we read the book of Yonah on Yom Kippur, as a reminder to a person, you think that you can get away with doing what you need to do, but and he writes explicitly, like without any embarrassment. And if you don't, you're just going to come back again and again and again. And to me, seeing that in the Mishnah Brura is an example in which it's just become part of the Jewish world as accepted understanding that we will come back again, and if you don't get it right the first time, not to worry, you will have another opportunity to do it again. Which brings us to the main meat and potatoes of our discussion, the purpose and nature of this idea of reincarnation. Why should this be? Yeah?
So when someone's reincarnated, are they coming back to the same family tree?
Generally not.
No.
I don't think so.
So then the generations aren't going to suffer then?
That person. So in other words, yeah, that's not a direct... No, it's on the simple meaning, it's the same generation, so you have to explain why. If you look at it in the Kabbalistic interpretation, it's that soul will keep coming back. So it could come back in any form. It doesn't have to necessarily... It's not literally a father and a son.
Grandchildren are not going to suffer for the
right, that's correct. No, because on the Kabbalistic interpretation of that verse, that soul is going to come back as another generation. That's what we call the second generation. And then it will come back a third time. That's its third generation. But it might be, I don't know, 50, 100, 200 years apart. It could be a different family.
Is there a time frame for reincarnation? Can you die
the next day? I can tell you, at the end of this packet, which I'm not going to spend time on, but I gave it to you. It's at the end of the packet. The course that we're using here put together a series of secular sources. This is a major study that's being undertaken throughout the world right now on this concept of reincarnation, in which there are institutes that are keeping track of stories that seem to imply very strongly this idea of reincarnation. There's a story in your notes here, right after 9/11, within 10 years of 9/11, of children... are really the craziest story, when children are saying things, speaking languages that they've never been exposed to, having pieces of information, names of people and places that they couldn't possibly have ever known. These are being documented, and there are lots of such cases. I gave you a couple in the back of your packet. You could take a look at some point if you either want, if you're getting bored with what I'm saying, or at the end of the class, where this is not something that, where it's actually being documented, in which there's very little explanation for how this is taking place, other than if this person's soul has somehow been there. And some of the documented cases, in order to be able to really prove it, are where it's within several years of the person who has died has seemingly come back in some other form. And all of that is sort of interesting stuff. Okay, let's go through the purpose and nature of reincarnation. Now again, the source of all this, and I've referenced this a couple of times already, just off the cuff, but let's just spend a moment speaking about it. Why are we here? Why do we exist? Why were we created as human beings in the first place? So to reference an entire hour and a half class that we did last year, in essence, God desired to do good for us, to bestow His kindness upon us, and the best way that He deemed for Him to bestow His kindness upon us is for us to actually earn that kindness. That's a more geschmack, a more pleasurable type of reward, as if you've done something to earn it, rather than if I gave it to you for free. And in order for us to earn it, so you have to create a system in which we have free will. And only then, where we actually have choices between that which is right and that which is wrong, if we choose right, we can actually earn our reward. And therefore, the earth was created in all of its darkness and hidden realities so that we can choose between that which is right and that which is wrong. Well, the difficulty, the danger, so to speak, the risk that God took in order to be able to give us the best possible good, in order to do so, we have to give us free will. In order to give us free will, we also have the choice to actually and choose wrong, which we're all familiar with. That's the intrinsic risk in being able to give us the best possible good, which comes as a result of choosing right. But by definition, in order to give us that chance, we also have to have a chance to choose wrong and to mess up. And then when we do that, not only are we not getting the best possible good, if you remember my analogy I gave you, if I gave it to you for free, it would be a 7 on our scale. It's for free, so it's not so great out of 10, but it's pretty good, but it's only a 7. And God says, I don't want to give you a 7, I want to give you a 10. But there's only one way I can give you a 10, because since I'm God, and godliness is intrinsic from within, that means that the good that you have to get has to have come and emanated from within, from you. You have to earn it to get a 10. And I want to give you a 10, but you failed, and you only got a 3. And so now, I wanted to give you a 10, I could have given you a 7, I want to give you a 10, and now I'm stuck giving you a 3. So this concept, now what do I do with you? For all of eternity, you're going to get a 3? Eternity's a long time. So everything that we're now going to discuss and have been discussing is rooted in that concept of, I could have given you a 7, but I want you to have a 10. Because I am God. And because I am God, I mean, this is God speaking, obviously. Because God is God and He wants to give you a 10, He can give you a 10. Nothing less than a 10 will be full expression of godliness. We then have to get a perfect 10. And until we get a perfect 10, the full expression of godliness will not be there. Because it's only going to be a full expression of godliness if the kindness that He gives is in its fullest state. This idea of the human being reaching his full, his or her full potential, full actualization of everything that they can be, coming as close to perfection as humanity allows for, is what's going to be at the root of this idea of, well, if it didn't work the first time, I'm not ready to stop here, says God. We have to get this right. So let's take a look at how this is expressed. There are a number of different angles that this is taken from, and as anything that's deep and complicated, there is no one simple answer to anything. So whenever there's no simple one answer to anything, so we're going to see a number of different angles that are described by various commentators to explain why it is that we would have to come back multiple times. What aspects are we here to fulfill, to fix, to change, and to better? Let's start right away with the simplest, which is actually the Zohar. It's on page 7. I'm going to skip a little. We're going to go back. But if you skip to page 7, source number 4. This is the simplest, straightforward, right out of the Zohar. The Zohar writes, Kol zmana debarnash lo yitzlach b'hai alma, as long as a person is unsuccessful in fulfilling his purpose in this world, Kodesh Brichu, the Holy One, blessed is He, Okerle, will uproot him, v'notale b'kama zimnin, and will replant him over and over again. Simple, straightforward, to the point. You don't succeed, says the Zohar. You will be, listen to the word, like uprooted and replanted. Why? Because when we're in this world, that's our experience. The soul, which was living in bliss in the world of souls, was uprooted from its world of souls and thrown down here together with its body. As the Mesil Shisharim, Rav Moshe Chaim Lusato writes many times, do you think if you were to ask a soul, where would you rather be right now? Would you rather be in the world of souls close to God, or would you rather be in that place called earth with all that comes along with it? So the soul, if you were to ask that, if you were to ask it that question, the soul would say, I like it right here. I don't want to go down there. Not only because I might fail, but this is the goal. I'm right now in the goal. But I didn't earn it fully. So you have to be uprooted and replanted, where you're going to grow and develop and be nurtured, hopefully to the point where you can then achieve that perfection. But says the Zohar, straightforward, if you don't succeed the first time in achieving that purpose, that perfection, you will be uprooted and sent back down again. If you look on the bottom of page 6, you'll see three things that are quoted by the Arizal. The Arizal, again, was Rabbi Yitzchak Luria. Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, known as the Arizal, was one of the prime conduits of all of the Kabbalah, the Lurianic Kabbalah as we know it, in Sfat, and I believe it was the 16th century. And he wrote the Shar HaGilgulim. He wrote an entire sefer on Gilgul, on this idea of reincarnation. And he offers several reasons. Let's just read them together. Number one, repairing spiritual damage that was incurred through transgressions in a previous life. A person can actually do something wrong. You do something wrong, the Chafetz Chaim, again, the Mishnah Brewer, uses the following analogy, based on Chazal. Each one of the 613 mitzvahs corresponds to a part of our body. The sages describe there are the different limbs and sinews. Every part of our body has a corresponding mitzvah, either a positive mitzvah or a prohibition that we're not allowed to do. And every one of them that we keep, so to speak, gives life to our spiritual body. Meaning, I'm combining analogy. Like our spiritual, we have like a spiritual body that corresponds to the mitzvah that we do. So in the same way as in our physical body, there are some things which are more important than others. If a person, heaven forbid, loses a toe. So how much does that impact their life? Alright, so it could be a lot, could be a little, but they could probably learn to manage pretty well without it, to the point where most people who know them don't even know that they're suffering from that particular ailment. What if a person, Rahman Hassan, loses a leg or an arm? So it's much more critical to their functioning, but you still can function. What if a person loses a lung? A heart? I can't live at all. There are some organs that we have that are life-giving. A brain, heart, liver, kidney. Kidneys, you could have two, but if you lose both. Those are function. Those are your critical organs. And then we have lots of others, which all of them, when they're functioning well, are obviously to our betterment, but we can deal with some of them. The same thing we have in our spiritual life. There are certain mitzvahs which are the heart. Chavetz Chaim would say, what do you think is the heart of the Jewish spiritual life? Shabbos. Shabbos is the heart. Keeping Shabbos gives life to the heart in the spiritual sense. And there are other mitzvahs which are more significant, but all of them have some aspect of the spiritual makeup of the soul. And if it's not perfected, if a person actually has damaged one of those spiritual limbs, says the Arizal, you can be pretty sure you'll be sent back down to make sure that that spiritual limb is remedied, fixed, taken care of on the next go-around. So that's an actual repair. Something was done to damage the spiritual existence of the soul, and therefore that spiritual aspect of the soul has to be fixed. Number two, achieving a level of perfection that was not achieved previously. I didn't do anything wrong, I just didn't achieve what I could have. There was something in me that was supposed to be brought out to the world, and I didn't do it. Taking a simple analogy, that book that I meant to write never was written. What if that book would have inspired thousands? You didn't do it. You didn't take care of it. An act of kindness that you could have done. I didn't do anything wrong. It's not that I have a blemish on my soul. It's not that I didn't do a certain mitzvah that has caused some a blemish that I need to fix. It's just that I didn't fully actualize the potential, the soul that I had. And if you haven't fully actualized, it comes back. So either to fix the blemish, to fully actualize oneself, or number three, only one may be reincarnated for the purpose of helping others to reach their spiritual perfection. So Rizal suggests you might be sent back because what you have to offer, that person needs. They need you to achieve their perfection, and you might be sent back in order to be able to achieve that spiritual perfection, because at the end of the day, Klal Yisrael is really one big unit. And if for whatever reason that person needs this, so then you'll be sent back. Those are the three suggestions the Arizal himself makes why a person might be sent back. Giving you another source, if you look at source number 3 on page 7, the Reishis Chochmo and the Shahar Yir, also Kabbalistically inclined, Sefer writes that reincarnation is necessary for the soul, even though it goes through the concept of Gehenim anyway. When a person dies, so the first place that its soul goes is to Gehenim, which is loosely translated as hell or purgatory, but that has so many Christian connotations it's unclear what. I don't like using those words. A person goes to Gehenim and is purified there. However, so why would I need to come back into this world? So he quotes from his Rebbe, the Ramak, Ramosha Chaim Lutzato, or Cordovero, Ramosha Cordovero, that there are two reasons. One, because a person may be lacking in the observance of certain commandments which are needed for perfection. And Gehenim can only purify but not add that which is lacking. A similar idea to what we saw in the Arizal. If you're missing something, Gehenim can clean, but it can't add something to your spiritual soul. Meaning if my clothing is dirty, I can clean out a stain, but if my clothing is missing the sleeve, my jacket isn't there, you take it to the cleaners all you want. The cleaners isn't going to put a sleeve on. You have to go to a seamstress for that. So reincarnation is taking it to a seamstress to add on the sleeve. Gehenim only cleans that which needs to be cleaning. As he writes, and then he says, there's some sins which can't even be purified even in Gehenim. Now what this does is you see on the Ramchal on the bottom of page 7, moving on to page 8, source number 6, there is a concept that this helps out in a very serious way. There's the question in Jewish philosophy, which has been asked all the way back from Moshe until modern times, is why is it that the righteous seem to suffer and the wicked seem to prosper? It's a question which we cannot seem to come to an answer to, or for, or have any understanding. And there's a reason for that, because we don't understand the ways of God. And that's the sense we don't. Without the concept of reincarnation, we can still address that question and say, listen, the person you're looking at, he looks like a righteous individual, she looks like a pretty righteous person, but who really knows what's going on? Or who knows how this is preparing them for the next world? When you bring it into the discussion of Gilgal, the discussion of the transmigrations of the souls, all of a sudden that question becomes a lot easier to deal with. Why is this seemingly righteous person suffering? Well, if this is that soul's second or third go-around at it, who knows what it was that they were sent here for, and it looks to you like they're suffering, and they seem like a pretty good person, but who knows what it is that's being rectified, taken care of from a previous experience, that the reason why they were sent here is to deal with whatever trouble it is that they're dealing with, and that's what's happening right now. That is a very, I say it sort of like quickly and just throwing it out there, but to the Baalei Kabbalah, to the students of Kabbalah, looking at a world in a deeper, more mystical, under the surface reason, the question of why is this one suffering becomes, I don't even have to pretend to try to answer that. Who knows why this one is suffering? Who knows what the purpose of this person? Maybe that was a great question for Moshe to ask, because in Moshe's time, all the souls that were living were first-timers. I could ask the question. This person seems to be very good. I could actually trace their life from birth to where they are right now. This doesn't make sense to me. That's a great question. Today, where the Baalei Kabbalah say, for sure none of us are first-timers. We've all been here before. We've all experienced this life in one way or another. And now our soul is back to try to perfect something. So the question of, well, why do the righteous suffer in our generation is much less of a perplexing question, given that we don't even know a quarter of the story. Who knows what's gone on in the past, that whatever it is that we need to deal with, which is why something might be happening in front of us right now. Yeah? Say that again? Yeah. Yeah, so I can't answer that question. What I can tell you is there are, this we've discussed a little bit, there are four different concepts or parts of the soul. And they range from within inanimate objects to animate objects. A fish, a plant has to have something which is giving it life. So there's some level of the soul in the plant, animal, non-Jew, Jew. Within the concept even of a Jewish soul, that soul is broken up into four or five different components of what they are, and all of that is well beyond my understanding. The next thing I'm going to talk about is, can a soul come back as something else? Can part of a human Jewish soul come back as a non-Jew, inanimate object even, or an animal? Are there sources for that? That's what we're going to get to in a second. How, why, those are good questions. Very, very good questions. What I did want to then talk about is that exact point. That's literally the next thing. If you look on page 8 and page 9, just two sources which I think are of note and worth mentioning. Sefer HaRedim writes, the Kabbalists, the bottom of page 8, the Kabbalists say that even though a soul reincarnated in a human body is unaware of its initial incarnation, does not know, nevertheless, when it is incarnated in the body of an animal or a bird, it is aware of its former incarnation, and it has anguish and regrets over how it has descended from the human form to the form of a beast. So the Sefer HaRedim, what's he taking as a given? That you can come back even in the form of an animal. So you should all feel pretty good about yourselves that you were all reincarnated as people. That's pretty good. We made it through this one. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not familiar with that.
You've never heard that?
No.
Oh, someone's just telling you that because I'm a dog lover.
Uh-huh.
Dogs
do. Specifically dogs, as opposed to like a cat?
Well, I know maybe it was a belief or one of those...
I'm saying, what I mean today is, do they mean animals or do they mean something about dogs? Yeah, so I'm not familiar. I mean, any animal life has to have some type of a soul. There are levels of souls I mentioned, plant life, animal life. I'm not familiar with any sort of, I'm not saying it's not out there. I'm not well versed in any of these topics, whether or not a dog is or is something specific. But clearly, according to the Sefer HaRedim, his point is to say that the soul recognizes it and is anguished over coming back as an animal, but that it's clear that he holds that a soul actually can come back as an animal. And if you see the next source, it's from the Arizal. Again, the Rabbi Yitzchak Luria himself, after a person dies, he is punished for his transgressions in many ways, even before he enters Gehenna. And these ways are called Gilgul. Now again, the way that Arizal is saying it is as follows. Before you can enter into Gehenna, which is a purification process, you might first have to come back through this Gilgul. He may be reincarnated in an inanimate object, or in a plant, or in an animal, or in a human. Most people will not escape their being reincarnated in these ways. The degree of transgression determines whether he will be reincarnated in a plant or an animal, etc., or in a human. Yeah?
So how can he fix anything if he's an inanimate object?
Excellent. So clearly, if he's coming back as some type of inanimate object, whatever it is that it needs to be fixed can be done in that way.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever that, in other words...
You mean like a table?
You know, there's a well-known story, I'm sure it's a Hasidish story, of someone who came back as a fish to be eaten on Shabbos, at Shalman Shabbos. You know, like they their fulfillment was being a gefilte fish, you know, come back as, you know. But if you ever catch one, let me know. But and very hard to understand. What I'm expressing is, and again, I'm limited in what I know about this. This is all very Kabbalistic in nature, that there's a concept. The concept is sourced not only that a soul can come back, but can even come back as an inanimate object. I do want to stress, I meant to say this in the beginning, but now is as good a time as any other to say this. I heard from Rabbi Zev Lef, who I listened to a couple of lectures on this topic from other Rabbanim, much greater than I, to get some background. So he began his lecture as, you know, he was asked to speak about reincarnation, and I said to myself, this is what he said, I can barely keep track of my own soul and my own body. Like, what are we worrying about what souls I was before? Just focus on what's in front of you and don't worry about it. And that's true. At the end of the day, all of this is nice. And what changes when you leave here from what came? Nothing. Keep Shabbos, kosher, do mitzvahs, be nice. It's all the same. Do what you need to do. But also, and there's an aspect of knowing what's going on in the spiritual world around us. And there is a spiritual world around us, and we don't see it, but it is complex, it is developed, and it is, as far as the Sifrei HaKabbalah are concerned, the real world. We're not in the real world right now. We're just in this little mask of a physical world that keeps our soul busy. But there is such a concept. What does it mean? How do you come back as a plant? That's a good question. I don't know. Maybe come back as a dog, and you're some Jew's best friend, and I don't know. I really have no idea how that works. Not from a human level, not from a plant level. I'm just sort of giving you some of the ideas behind it as best I can. Okay, a few last points. So what are some of the philosophical implications as you see beginning of section 3 then the bottom of page 9? So we have an idea of being particularly, I mentioned, sometimes feeling that you are particularly challenged in a specific task. If you look at the Arizal again in source 2, on page 10, that you will therefore understand that which we find in the Talmud, that a certain sage was careful in a certain mitzvah to a greater degree than in other mitzvahs. And another sage was conscientious in a different mitzvah. As you just, there's this idea that one person senses, feels, or is more engaged in a particular mitzvah. And we look around, you sometimes find that there are different people who take upon themselves certain mitzvahs, or they're the one in charge of certain aspects, and they're drawn to certain things. The Ramchal writes as well in source number 3, when an individual has a reincarnated soul, it is possible that he will be affected in a particular manner as a result of his deeds in a previous incarnation. The situation in which he is placed may follow from this, and this situation may bring with it special responsibility given to him as discussed earlier. That he just... different people find themselves in certain lots in life, faced with certain specific challenges, and that's the challenge that you always just... why am I always dealing with this? A person might say, why am I always dealing with financial issues? I'm always dealing with a difficulty in this area. I find Shabbos is just impossible for me. For everybody else, it seems like a breeze. And for me, it is impossible between my work and my family where I live. Why is it so hard for me, and for everyone else it's so easy? I don't know, but if that's what it is, it's worth taking note. That's a mitzvah that you find particularly difficult, and it seems everybody else is able to manage. Maybe that's something that you need to do here. I do want to point out also, now is as good a time as any other, that there's a great, a tremendous work that came out recently in the last 4 or 5 years known as Bilvavi Mishkan Evne. It's a Hebrew Sefer. We actually had the speaker here in Atlanta not long ago. It's a very deep philosophical work, but very practical on a person growing. And he writes, his whole introduction to that sefer is, it is a mistake for anyone to think that they were brought here for one particular thing. And if they do that one thing, like, they're good. If you're back here, if you're living today, even if you are a reincarnated soul, you need to do everything. You need to build the whole life. And then when your life is built, maybe you'll find that right thing, the one thing, whether you know it or you don't know it. But you can't perfect the one thing if you haven't addressed the entire human being. The entire human being and all of his spiritual needs has to take care of everything. And then maybe if you're a zocha, if you're lucky, if you merit it, you'll hit the right thing that you needed to do. But you can't live your life looking for that one thing and neglect everything else. The whole system has to be in place in order to get that last thing corrected. Yeah.
Except that according to this was on H, that every human being is born with a nefesh and a neshama.
Okay.
Animals are born with just a nefesh.
There you go.
So the neshama is that spark of soul that allows us to relate to Hashem.
Great.
And animals are
okay.
That's what I do.
Not as dogs.
No, I wouldn't.
Sorry, I guess as a dog lover, I sort of personally as dogs.
Yeah.
I just wanted to.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, for moving further, as I mentioned, you also find the idea of why the righteous suffer, the Vilna Gaon. I mentioned this a few moments ago. The Vilna Gaon writes in source number 10, page 10, source number 1 on the bottom, that somebody was a wicked person in his first incarnation, so God will bring him down in the time of the waning of the moon. And he lives a life of poverty, even though he is now righteous. Say, well, that's so unfair. He's so righteous. Why is he poverty? Struck him. Well, that's because of something that was done previously. And that's simply, as we mentioned, simply something, as we mentioned, because of the fact that it's hard, and you can't know or judge the righteous and why they're suffering when there's so much more at stake. Human injustice. The Degel Machane Ephraim, who was the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, source number 1 on page 11, has quotes from the Zohar. The Zohar writes in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim. Mishpatim is the first parsha we read after the giving of the Torah in Parshas Yisro. Eila Mishpatim, and it describes the most mundane daily lives. If my ox gores your ox, if I dig a pit and somebody falls in it, all of those mundane laws as to how you deal with it. And the Zohar quotes, the very first line of that parsha, which is the most mundane, technical, detail-oriented parsha that we have, says, this is the secret of reincarnation. This verse of this parsha of the Mishpatim, the laws, it's reincarnation. Degel Machane Ephraim comments, what does that have to do with reincarnation? This is the last place you would find reincarnation, talking about cows and goring and this and the other. And it says, because when you talk about the laws, detail laws, financial laws, monetary laws, what often happens in living life is you feel like you were wrong. If you went to a court and the two defendants, or the two litigants, put forth their cases, and the judges rule, they have to rule this one versus that one, and somebody walks out feeling it's not right. I should have been owed that money. It should have been coming to me. I don't understand why this happened or that happened. And in order to understand monetary law and human judges get putting forth and applying the laws of the Torah, says the Zohar, before you can learn those laws, you have to know the secret of reincarnation. Because there are going to be instances where you, as a human being, are going to leave a court of law, and you apply the laws of the Torah as best you could, and are going to leave saying, that wasn't fair. It's not right. I know that I really should be owed that money. So the Zohar says, before you start learning these laws, just know that life is more complicated in the spiritual life, and there's a secret of reincarnation. And when you suffer human injustice, it's not over just because you walked out of a courtroom. And that we're just, our clothing that we wear is housing our soul, but our soul is eternal, and it has various trips here along the way. I do want to mention before we close, if you look on page 12, part D and part E, also very important concept, which is worth mentioning, and no one has any idea. But we don't understand, but it's worth mentioning also. We talk about the concept of premature death and the concept of disabilities. And there are certain things in life which are so immensely painful, so incomprehensible to us. Children born with disabilities that never had a chance in life. Just say, I don't understand. How can it be that a God of kindness creates such a child? How does that work? How can it be that such a sweet, innocent child loses a life prematurely? There are questions that we have that are inexplicable. Simply no answer, and nothing that I will even pretend to present. But we have sources that say you have to understand, especially in the time of age that we're living, where a soul that's here now is not in its first go-around, what it was that soul needed to accomplish. And very often, as the Chafetz Chaim writes, that a child who dies young might have been the reincarnation of a great person who just needed that perfection of having lived in this world and never having done anything wrong. And similarly with children with disabilities, where the Chazon Ish, if you see Reb Mordechai Becher, who's also been here as a speaker, quoted that the Chazon Ish, who was one of the great rabbis of the early 1900s in Eretz Yisrael, tremendous luminary, used to stand up for people with Down syndrome. Stand up for them, because he held that they were a pure soul that had been brought from a previous life, whose clearly their mission was to be a pure soul throughout their whole life in this world. And every person is given its faculties, and they allow them to reach their potential, and so on, as you see that he writes. But there's aspects that we don't understand, and no one can claim that every time something like that happens, that's what's going on. We don't know what's going on, and that's the answer. We don't know. What we do know is that the soul is eternal. We do know that the soul is the essence of who we are, and that the soul, eventually, from the time that it dies, will be brought back to life in Tchiyas HaMeisim. That we know. Will it have to go through several other journeys here to get it right until Tchiyas HaMeisim? So, as we've seen a plethora of sources from the Hasidisha world, from the Litvaks, from the Misnagdim, from the Vilna Gaon, to the Chafetz Chaim, and of course to the Kabbalists, a very strong, resounding, absolutely, it is something that is very much possible. If you're interested, there are some fascinating stories on page 14, both story number one and story number two, totally not Jewish sources, are really, really interesting stories that you could read about this idea of reincarnation. That's the concept. It is well sourced in Jewish thought. I'll take a question in a second. I just want to review and repeat one concept. There is no overt reference that we find in the Chumash and the Mishnah, but it is in numerous concepts that are traced back to the Chumash. And certainly it is rooted in Kabbalah, and it has taken hold in the Jewish world. Once the Vilna Gaon, the Ramban, Chafetz Chaim write about it as if it is clear and obvious to all, it is today certainly a major part of traditional Jewish thought that it is there. How it works, that we don't seem to, and maybe some of the sources, if you look at them inside, will give you a little bit more insight. But exactly what it looks like and how it looks like and all those good questions, unclear. What seems to be clear across the board is it's in some way to amend, to fix, to perfect that which we're all here for anyway. And as the Chafetz Chaim writes, as I quoted earlier, so if you want to throw off the yoke of that burden now, because you don't want to get involved and you don't want to deal with it, so he says, it's going to happen to you anyway, because you're just coming back. So get it right, says the Chafetz Chaim. Spend the time, spend the effort, get it right now so that you don't have to come back again. There's a couple of questions. Yeah, first you. I don't know. That's generally, you know, we want to instill, the Gemara says that you give a name to a person, it instills certain characteristics of that name. I can't tell you whether or not, how that impacts whether or not what you're actually giving, you know, because the Sfarim, of course, have the custom of naming after the living, so they're clearly not, you know, transmigrating that soul, the person's, you know, holding the baby. I don't believe that custom has to do with actually that much. I don't think so. But I'm hesitant to say, but I don't think so. Yeah, Dan.
The Homer says 600,000 men at Sinai, a total of 3 million. There have been multi millions of Jews since Sinai. Were the souls from these original 3 million, did God make, does the Zohar say that God made the souls for the multitudes of Jews that followed them?
They were already there. I believe the language of the Gemara, if I remember correctly, is that there was like a storehouse of souls that at some point in history was emptied, where everybody had come into existence once. But that was not necessarily... I think there are sources that say that at Har Sinai all those souls were present, not as people, but at least as souls. But there was a storehouse of souls, is the language that the sages use. And then after they've all been around, what? But that was a finite number of souls. And then after that, we're all just, you know, we didn't get it all right the first time. We've been brought back again. That seems to be my understanding in a very simple, broad stroke.
With the storehouse, you're saying more than the 3 million.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So it's my understanding that I was always told when you die that you will meet the loved ones that
right. Yeah. No. You're asking one of those great questions. Like, what happens if, you know, there was a couple that was married, and then one of them is back here when the other one dies? Like, what happens? Like, great question. I don't know. That's a good one. Like, what happens? How does, like, there's this a concept, I don't know how much of it is like the way that we speak, that you'll be reunited with, that's certainly a way that we talk. I don't know, it's a good question. It's a good question, yeah.
So, if a person then comes back several times, then what body does he come back in?
That's right, how that works, in other words, I don't know. In other words, if there's going to be a Tchias HaMeisim when the person comes back, but they've been back here 4 or 5 times, how do you combine that concept of Tchias HaMeisim, which seems to be that you will come back out of the bone? There's a certain bone, the loose bone, that the Gemara says that the body will be reconstructed from. But I've, the soul's been here 4 or 5 times already. I don't know. You know, that's the same question of, let's say, a couple got married 600 years ago in their first go-around, 700 years, and now each one's been back 5 times, they've been married to 6 different people. How does that work? Great question. I have no idea. But Mirtz Hashem, Mashiach should come tomorrow, we'll find out. We'll enter the Eretz Chiyas HaMeisim. I don't know.
And could we also have a little piece of the different souls? Now, somebody told me you can have a part of this person's soul and this person's soul, and it's in different people.
I don't know. Yeah.
What happens if somebody does the Batshuva? Somebody like repents and does all the mitzvahs and stuff, and beforehand, they will not do the mitzvahs. What happened with that soul?
Will they have to come back?
Right.
So the answer, if they got everything right by the time they died, and they had achieved whatever it was that their mission was, so then according to our sources, we would say no. But even though a person might have been about, if they didn't achieve whatever perfection they could have, then maybe yes, still. I don't know. Well, this class has created many more questions than any other class I've ever taught of. I'll stay for as long. I'm happy to take. If everybody else wants to listen, that's fine. But I don't want to keep everybody. But I'm happy to keep answering as many as I can. Yeah.
What about converts? Where do they get the soul?
Right, I was saying that. So the convert, so a person converts, so when a person emerges from the mikvah as a convert, so they're instilled with this new level Jewish soul. So, you know, how does, you know, where do they, you know, were they a Jew in the first go around and then they came back as a non-Jew in order to be able to come to it on their own? I don't know how that works. As I said, like, this is going to give you some of the idea that the real answers, I don't know how that goes. Is there another question that somebody had over here? Yeah. Meaning, well, we don't know of any other life. I mean, it could be, but I don't know. Sure. So we don't know of anything else. So. Right, because the only thing that matters is when you go home tonight, they're going to keep kosher and Shabbos and be nice and like whatever, you know. I don't know. I know what's in front of me. What's in front of me is to be the best person I can be. What was my soul beforehand? What will it be? That's not my job. My job is, you know, be the most righteous and perfect person I can. That's my job. This is nice for talk and conversation, but my job is keep these mitzvahs.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.